and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Libya is holding a vote today in an effort to have a government of national unity. The country is in fragment with rival governments. 5 years after the NATO war against Libya and the overthrow of Gaddafi, how did it all come to this? And what's to be said of the threat that ISIL, the Islamic State, poses as President Obama is pressed by his top military advisors to open up a new front in Libya? The people of Flint, Michigan have been drinking poisoned water. They are fed up. They are protesting in the streets, and now they have taken Michigan authorities to court in what might be a landmark lawsuit. We speak to the attorneys. The former mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson, speaks out against the two-party political system that is of, by, and for the biggest Wall Street banks and transnational corporations. But first, we turn to Libya. Libya is holding a vote today to appoint a new cabinet that is aimed at bringing an end to the country's status of having two rival governments. 5 years after the NATO war against Libya and the overthrow of Gaddafi, how did it come to this? And what's to be said of the threat that ISIL poses as President Obama is pressed by his top military advisors to open a front, a new front in Libya? We are joined from London by Sukant Chandan. He is the coordinator of the British-based Malcolm X movement. He visited Libya three times in 2011 as part of a peace delegation. Welcome, Sukant.
Thank you for having me again, Brian.
Can Libya have a unity government at last after the talks today? And who are the rival sides, and how did the country end up with two competing administrations, or perhaps more?
Well, we're talking about encyclopedias of information here that we need to compact into a few minutes in this conversation. So I'll do my best. First of all, the two rival juntas or administrations or even governments, some people call them. In Tripoli, you have Libya Dawn, which is basically a something that's not too far from the Al-Qaeda ideology, I suppose. It's led by the death squads from Misrata. And really, they're occupying Tripoli. That I don't think many of the residents in Tripoli are too chuffed with having these death squads lording over them. And then the other administration or junta or government, perhaps, is based in Tobruk. And it's the Tobruk government which the West is in more strategic counter-opposition to than Libya Dawn in Tripoli. The Tobruk government has been asking for better weaponry, for it to be allowed to import better weaponry, and basically the West have blocked that. The Tobruk government is quite close to the Egyptian government. And the Tobruk government also, interestingly, has a reconciliation program with the former Jamhuriya, with the former supporters of Muammar Gaddafi, unlike Libya Dawn in Tripoli, who massacre and torture people from the Jamhuriya, from the former Libyan government. Actually, the Tobruk government has wants kind of peace and wants to put that in history and try to move forward. So that broadly what's happening. Now, the West need a unity government on paper to justify its next phase of military intervention, which it wants to do under the guise and the excuse of Daesh in Libya. And indeed, Daesh in Libya are a primary so-called quote-unquote rebel faction that the leading NATO powers teamed up with. Hakim Belhaj, longtime CIA MI6 asset, leader of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, is a leader of Daesh in Libya, and he was the most important military leader amongst the rebels of NATO's proxy forces there. So that broadly is the situation as we see it.
So ISIL or Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, is, from your point of view, perhaps it exists, but from your point of view, really a pretext for more Western military intervention?
Yeah, it's a little bit more sophisticated and complex than just a pretext, because as in the case of Iraq, as in the case of Syria, and as in the case of Libya, and also it should be mentioned Mali and increasingly Algeria, imperialist policies directly and indirectly bring to power, give oxygen to, bring to life this uncontrollable genie out of the imperialist lamp, which is Daesh. And then they kind of continue with this vicious war circle of creating the monster, then using the monster to create more of a mess, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's very clear. You can go back to the mainstream press in early 2011. The Western press was openly advocating anyone and everyone from the West and further afield to go to Libya, pick up weapons and support its illegal death squad project, which was the ground troops of the NATO bombing. Gaddafi was too much of a threat. He was too much of a threat to the leadership of Pan-Africa for the Pan-African strategy that he was affecting very effectively. He was too much of a threat in asking Libya to have a military alliance and Africa to have a military self-defense alliance with Chavez and Morales and other people. And they were discussing and trying to put that into operation. And thirdly, Gaddafi was too radical because he was directly assisting for many decades and continuing a new phase of support to Black and Asian people in Europe and other radical movements of white anti-imperialists and socialists, etc. He had to be cut off, so said imperialism. And that's what they did.
The Obama administration at first seemed to hesitate about going in full steam into Libya with the bombing campaign. They had a seeming debate in the first days after the beginning of the February protests in Benghazi. We had Robert Gates, who was then Secretary of Defense. He had been a holdover from the Bush administration. He made the point that we, meaning the United States, meaning the empire, did not have a strategic interest in Libya. Obama himself seemed to be hesitating. Then you had the Washington Post, essentially a neoconservative newspaper here in Washington that used to be considered the mainstream of the liberal press. Perhaps both have been conflated now. And others, like Hillary Clinton, who was then Secretary of State, demanding that the U.S. engage in bombing. It seemed here that after a few minutes of hesitation, Gates surrendered and Obama, as is his record, kowtowed to the demands of the militarists and the right wing and the neoconservatives and went along with it. Clinton, of course, said, "We came, we saw, he died," meaning, and she laughed, giggling on TV or it was caught in video. About the death, the assassination, the execution of Gaddafi on the day he was executed. Do you see or did you see at the time any sort of division within U.S. ruling circles about the advisability of the NATO bombing, given the what happened in Iraq in 2003?
Yes, this is an important element and dimension of this whole debacle and frankly tragic and sorry chapter of the history of the Global South and its relations with imperialism. It was very clear. I mean, when I went there in Libya towards the summer, the Libyan anti-imperialist patriots and freedom fighters against NATO were very clear, and I think they had good reason to be have some hope and prospects for NATO's project just collapsing. It wasn't getting anywhere. The rebels could literally only advance as NATO, I mean, literally bombed a path for them. And that path that was bombed had the incinerated bones of our comrades along it. Without NATO bombing, the rebels were going nowhere. The rebels were in disarray. And also, people can go back to the media in 2011. You had the political and French military leaders of France, Britain, the United States openly bickering with each other in the media. Basically, there were sections of the United States ruling circles that were very annoyed that the French and British were basically obliging the United States military to do most of the military legwork. You know, the NATO powers in Europe by themselves could not have carried out and could not have done the heavy lifting against Libya. So yeah, I think what you just said, your preamble just to this part of the conversation is generally correct. Hillary Clinton is the most hawkish, and frankly, what you cited there just it betrays her totally sociopathic side to her. And Musa Ibrahim, who was the last Jamhuriya government spokesperson, that I'm very proud to say that I consider him a brother and comrade. He did a very good job in advocating for peace and a resolution to the war in Libya. Made it very clear, for the first time, he spoke at a conference that myself and other comrades organized in the Houses of Parliament, facilitated by George Galloway at the time. He made it very clear at that conference in Parliament, you can go to YouTube and hear him, it was Hillary Clinton who has ensured that the death squads in Libya have a leading role to play in the junta in Tripoli. So all of these elements are quite complex, but yeah, in general, what you're saying is true. But the final thing is, be it in Syria or in Libya or Mali or Algeria and many other countries and homelands of our peoples of the global south, you can see this jostling, this inter-imperialist rivalry being played out. They're not going to go to war with each other, I don't think. There's any sign of that like they did in the First and Second World War. I think imperialism has made an agreement and understanding with each other that it's not worth going to world war with each other, because every time they do, half of the world turns socialist. But that being said, there still is a lot of jostling and maneuvering between them. And I think the British and French did a pretty clever job, actually, in Libya in their own regards, and getting the United States to do their own dirty work in Libya.
In the United States, in the corporate-owned media, and certainly from the government spokespeople, the discussions about Libya under Gaddafi used the most colorful, demonizing rhetoric and language, so much so that if one were to ask someone who was basically uninformed, not paying careful attention to what Libya was like under Gaddafi, they would just basically spout back that which the media is presenting. You were there. You were in Libya in 2011. I don't know if you had been there before 2011, but you do pay careful attention and you have a sense of what Libya was like under Gaddafi. Say for us, for our audience, especially for the U.S. audience that only gets spoon-fed this kind of demonizing language about what Libya was like, what the reality was.
Well, I actually criticized the Jamhuriya comrades in Tripoli, and it was friendly criticism, obviously. I went there, and you know, before I went there, you had all these what I call the snakes, fakes, fools, and tools of NATO just promoting this ridiculous lies and propaganda of the imperialists in relation to Libya. I remember one guy called, what's his name, Robin Kasib something. He was part of the Pulse magazine online. He was saying on my Facebook, there's a military curfew in Tripoli. There's snipers on the roof. People can't go out. And when I went to Tripoli the three times, I just said to the Libyan comrades, you know, you need a military curfew. You need more checkpoints. You're in a war against NATO and their death squads. This is like a summer holiday here in the summer. The Libyans were so laid back about things. It was incredible. It was a very laid-back society, even under war conditions. I mean, I remember hearing the NATO planes constantly buzzing in the skies, and then you hear the thuds every day of them bombing in and around Tripoli. So, but the Libyans were very confident that they would ride it through, that they had the support of the majority of their people, that the rebels didn't have mass support and enough support to overthrow and destroy the whole country. Unfortunately, due to some sellouts in the Libyan Jamhuriya army, and also the propaganda campaign, with you're facing the biggest military alliance, the most vicious, the most cunning military alliance that humanity has ever seen in NATO, and unfortunately that didn't happen. The Libyan people, and I visit many working class areas and housing projects, etc. They lived very well, and I think the Libya, and you know, it's well known that United Nations said Libya had the highest development index of any African country, and I think probably people in Libya had the best living standards of arguably of any people of the global south. But the ridiculousness of the whole situation of Libya and what the rebels wanted was encapsulated when I had a brief conversation with a pro-rebel young Libyan man on one of my flights to Tunisia, because you can only get to Libya through the land route through Tunisia, because NATO imposed a no-fly zone against the Jamhuriya army. And I said, listen, brother, you're about to get married, you're about to have children. You know, what do you concretely want to happen in Libya? You're supporting this this so-called uprising and NATO, etc. And he said to me, and this is, you know, this is absolute truth, and this is pretty much exactly what he said. He said, brother, he says, you know, every Libyan has a Japanese car. we want a Mercedes or a BMW. And that kind of summed up the whole thing. It was just a Mickey Mouse Coca-Cola revolution. And Mickey Mouse Coca-Cola revolutions never bring anything to the people of the Global South except a Mickey Mouse and Coca-Cola outcome.
You know, I just saw in the media here that there was a demonstration of Libyan students who are studying in the United States. And the reason they were demonstrating, they were at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. And the reason they were demonstrating, and this is a quote from one of their leaders, it's been a year, this is what they're not getting now from the Libyan government. It's been a year without tuition, health insurance, monthly allowance. We are really suffering, said the name of the Libyan citizen studying at the graduate level pharmacology. Now, for American students, that would be like something to really wonder about. You get an allowance, you get health insurance, you go to school without tuition. I mean, that's like lavish by American student standards. What was education like during the period in which Gaddafi ruled from 1969 until his execution in 2011?
Well, just on the martyrdom and execution of Muammar Gaddafi, just a few seconds on that. Listen, it was the most brutal, most graphic, most horrific martyrdom of any Global South leader I can think of that's been reported in such a graphic way. And the reason for that was a punishment to this, what I call this Pan-Africanist, Pan-Arab, Black Power Socialist Republic. That was the Jamhuriya. The lesson had to be taught, and the raping and the execution in the way it was of Gaddafi, it being splashed in every single Western front page and rolling for hours upon hours for days on the news, was they intended that to be a lesson for the people. Now, after the 1916 revolution of Muammar Gaddafi, within a year, the British base called Wheeler's Field was evacuated, and the US base was evacuated. They got told to go to hell, and they were expelled. As soon as that happened, there was fundamental land reform. Land was given to the tiller. That's a slogan in the Green Book of Muammar Gaddafi. There was labor dignity amongst the working class. There was a massive housing project. Indeed, Muammar Gaddafi said, until every Libyan is housed in a proper house, my parents will live in a tent. And indeed, I think it was his father who passed away in a tent and never got to live in an actual secure home. So much so did Gaddafi promise that to the Libyan people. And also on issues of education was free. You know, this was a young socialist country, only 41 years old by 2011. So there was a lot of things still remaining to do and develop. But the accomplishments really shone. Not only was Libya the shield of Africa, it was the star of Africa in the sense that Libya proved what was possible. Yes, Libya had a small population, 67 million, and it was a major oil-producing country. That's true. But you have countries with major mineral wealth all across Africa, and because of the looting, the genocidal looting by imperialism, they are still they still remain in a relative position of primitive development, or as Walter Rodney would say, European imperialist forced underdevelopment. And indeed, I visited universities in Tripoli, the Al-Fateh University, I think the Al-Nasser campus that was bombed by NATO as well. And it was good. It was, you know, modern facilities. People were looked after extremely well, including at university education. And indeed, now the young people of Libya are realizing, I mean, frankly, you know, not getting your fees paid for and your bursary from the Libyan government while living in a Western country is nothing compared to the absolute horror story that's been visited upon Libya since February 17th, 2011.
Sukhan, I know you don't have a crystal ball. You can't make predictions about the future with certainty, but there are some obviously clear trajectories in terms of U.S. and Western policies in the Middle East, certainly in Libya. We have about a minute left. If you can just say what you think the anti-ISIL coalition, so-called, that U.S.-led group of 23 countries that met in Rome the other day that said the United States must do something now in Libya. They weren't talking about Iraq. They weren't talking about Syria. Suddenly they're talking about Libya, and Libya's back on the front page. And today in the New York Times, it's Obama's military advisors are demanding a military front in Libya. What do you think is coming? I've taken half of your minute, so you have 30 seconds.
imperialism is terrified that the Libyan people are realizing the absolute disaster that's been visited upon them, and they've partly facilitated as well. They're worried that Libyans are uniting again to unify their country. They need Libya to be a destable death squad state to continue destabilizing Tunisia, Mali, Algeria, especially Egypt. But Libyans will keep on fighting, but I don't think there's going to be any real strategic possibility to the liberation of Libya for another generation at least yet, unfortunately.
Well, we want to thank Sukant Chandan for his observations, his insights. We are out of time for this segment. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. The people of Flint, Michigan have been drinking poisoned water in recent years. This has become a national and international scandal. Jesse Jackson on this show recently called Flint a crime scene. We are joined from Detroit, Michigan by attorney Julie Hurwitz, who has filed class action litigation lawsuits on behalf of the people of Flint, Michigan. Welcome, Julie Hurwitz.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've been talking about this story, as have media in the United States and around the world for the past weeks. Tell us first, what is your lawsuit? What are you suing for? Who are the plaintiffs? And what relief are you seeking?
Well, we, the legal team that I'm working with, which is my law firm, Goodman & Hurwitz, a very prominent civil rights firm in Royal Oak, Michigan, Pitt, McGee, Rivers, and Palmer, and local attorney Trachelle Young, and also Deborah LaBelle from Ann Arbor. Ms. Young is from Flint. We have filed three separate class action lawsuits, and I can explain why in a few minutes if you would like to know. But the first case has been filed in the United States District Court. It's a federal civil rights cause of action, a class action. We have several named plaintiffs, including Melissa Mays, who has been a very outspoken mother, parent, and resident of Flint. That case alleges violations of the United States Constitution, the substantive due process clause, for the violation of the Flint citizens' bodily integrity. We have named the governor himself, the state, the heads of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, all of the public officials who have been involved and responsible for making the decisions and participating in the mass cover-up that caused Flint to become a crime scene, as Reverend Jackson properly described it. We have a second case that's pending directly in a forum in the state of Michigan called the Court of Claims, which allows us to bring an action directly against the state of Michigan and the governor himself for damages for their conduct, which violated Flint citizens' rights under the Michigan Constitution. And we have a third case that has been filed in the local Genesee County Circuit Court under Michigan common law.
So the relief that you're seeking, I mean, here we have a city of more than 100,000 people, once a very thriving city, but today a very, very poor city. 41% of the people, I believe, live in poverty, which is a ridiculously high number, given the fact that the real poverty level, if it's really measuring true poverty, would probably be 70 or 80%.
Much higher, correct. A largely, predominantly African-American community as well.
Yeah, and there's the issue of environmental racism. I mean, how did it come to be, just because we have both a U.S. audience and a global audience, and of course we have a Michigan audience, the people in Michigan probably know it well, but for the others outside, how did it come to be that Flint water became poison? How did it come to be that the children in Flint today have elevated, dangerously elevated levels of lead in their system?
Well, I think the primary place to start is with a law, a very dangerous and radically right-wing law that was enacted back in 2010 called the Emergency Manager Law. And as a side note, I, along with the National Lawyers Guild and the Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice and the ACLU, have been fighting that law in a separate federal challenge since then. This law gave the governor of Michigan unilateral power to appoint a dictator to any municipality in the state which has been deemed to be in, quote, financial crisis. It has played itself out, as we predicted, that the only communities in which emergency managers have been appointed are those which are predominantly African American and impoverished. There are predominantly white communities in Michigan also suffering from economic crises which have not had emergency managers appointed. Through this power play, there have been numerous emergency managers appointed to the city of Flint since 2011 when Governor Snyder took power. This this law allows these emergency managers literally to make unilateral decisions over the entire governance of these communities. And these emergency managers took a look at the water situation, the contract with the city of Detroit, which had been for 60 or 70 years providing clean water to that community. The contract was coming up for renewal. And the emergency managers all got together, we believe, and decide with the governor and decided what a great thing. We can save the city of Flint a couple million dollars. We can negotiate a deal with this new regional water authority, the KWA, on which, by the way, several of these defendants sits on the board of directors, and we can get cheaper water into Flint. But there was a problem, and that is that the contract with the city of Detroit ended in 2014. But the KWA pipeline was not going to be up and running until the end of 2016. So what did they do? They decided, rather than to renegotiate a more favorable contract with Detroit, there were some behind-the-closed-doors conversations that we have yet to learn all the details of, although several of them are coming to light now, let's use the Flint River. What the heck? And
before that, the water supply was from the Detroit River. So
the water supply was from Lake Huron.
Lake Huron, okay.
Coming through the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, which is considered some of the cleanest public municipal water anywhere.
So the emergency managers appointed by the governor who have usurped local control, it's not the mayors, not the city council, it's these emergency managers, as you call them, dictators. They make a decision.
Accountable to no one but the governor.
We can save a few million bucks by changing Flint, Michigan's water from what had been a previously a good water source, a clean water source, to something else. That didn't work out exactly in terms of timing, so they opted for, hey, let's get the water from the Flint River.
Yeah, that'll be really cheap.
Yeah, and so then when people got new water, the water now from the Flint River, did they know that it was bad? Did they know it right away?
They knew it immediately. As soon as they switched over, the water was smelly, it was discolored, it tasted horrible. People were starting to suffer from skin problems, their hair was falling out. It was undrinkable. It was not potable water. And there were complaints that were immediately starting to be communicated all the way from Flint to Lansing. And the complaints were essentially ignored. Relax, this is perfectly good water. In fact, they blatantly lied. High-level officials from the MDEQ blatantly lied to this one EPA investigator who was one of the people to actually help blow the lid off what was really going on, Mr. Del Toro. He said, are you using corrosion control treatments in this water? And the fact is, they were not. That's what caused this problem. That's one of the serious causes of the problem. They lied to him and said, oh, yeah, we're using it. No problem. And in fact, they lied. They were not. And they knew they were not. and they knew there were serious risks of high lead levels. They knew that the Flint River was once some of the most already known to be, I believe, up to 9 times more corrosive than the water that they had previously been getting from Detroit. And the corrosion is what destroys the pipelines, it destroyed the infrastructure, and it caused massive amounts of lead that had previously been buffered by the phosphate treatments that's the anti-corrosion technique they use, had created a buffer between the lead in the pipes and the water that was flowing through those pipes. When the phosphates stopped being in the water, the hyper-corrosive acids in the Flint River water immediately started just destroying the linings of these very old pipes, and the lead just started pouring in. And on top of the lead, before they even realized how serious the lead problem was, they were immediately aware of high levels of E. coli bacteria, and then they dumped a bunch of chlorine into the water, which then the side effect of chlorine is this other chemical, the it's TTHM, and I can never remember the name of that chemical, but that is a known carcinogen that was found to be in high levels in the water from the chlorine treatments. So it just was one parade of horribles after the other. And the folks who run this state and who run these agencies knew full well what risks they were looking at and what dangers they were creating in this water system. And they, in a level of arrogance and disregard for the rights of those citizens, they covered it up, they manipulated the test results, they lied to the federal agencies, and they lied blatantly to the public.
It's an amazing sequence of events. Really amazing, as you explain it. And it just gets worse and worse. So now you have the water so corrosive that not only was the water that people were drinking originally poisoned, but then it destroyed the pipes, and the pipes leached lead into the water, adding to the problem. You know, we talked to people from the Flint Water Study. They're, I'm sure you're aware, at Virginia Tech. And I want to quote Mark Edwards, who was one of the people who has been a leader of this study. He said, yeah, this, what he found in Flint, when they went there and found all of these elevated lead levels, terrible pollutants, all of it, he said, it exposes a new level of arrogance and uncaring that I have never encountered. You think that's an overstatement?
I think that's an understatement. Frankly, I think that the history of the trajectory that our state government has been on since Rick Snyder has been elected governor in this state is so frightening that the what occurred in Flint should be no surprise to anyone. And the level of arrogance and uncaring was not just arbitrary, it was deliberate. And the racism, the inherent racism and class bias that these decisions exemplify are just shocking.
I mean, it is shocking. If this had happened in a city that was, let's say, predominantly upper class, or not upper class, but middle class or affluent, seemingly affluent or somewhat affluent white people, this wouldn't have gotten this far.
Never would have happened. And we have elected officials now finally understanding the true nature of environmental racism in this country. Representative Dan Kildee has publicly announced that, in fact, he now understands if this had occurred in a predominantly white middle-class community in Michigan, they never would have gotten away with this. If you're disenfranchised, if you're powerless, we can do this and we can get away with it. And the sad fact is, all too often, that's true.
Well, that's why it seems to me that your lawsuits and the lawsuits filed by your firm, which has a long, long tradition advocating for poor people, for people of color, for their civil rights, their social rights, their economic rights. It seems to me that that is so vitally important. We do have a movement in the streets. People are protesting. Yes. There's a lot of grassroots activism. But yes, what kind of relief can the people who have been so harmed by what's happened, what kind of relief can they win through the courts?
Well, first and foremost, the injuries that have occurred to these victims is, as everyone I think now concedes, even Governor Snyder in his State of the State address concedes, these injuries are irreparable. The harm has been done, and there is nothing that can be done to undo it. There are steps that can be taken to minimize it. There are steps that can be taken to hopefully, you know, slow down the injury that's caused by high lead exposure. But the harm has been done. So first and foremost, we're talking about compensation to these victims. We're talking about enforceable judgments judicial oversight of whatever promises that are now being made by the state to make sure that medical monitoring take place in a meaningful way, that the infrastructure be replaced as soon as possible, that there be some way of overseeing whatever remedial steps are in the works to ensure that they occur and that they occur properly. So there's, and in the federal district court case under the Federal Civil Rights Act, these plaintiffs have a right to recover punitive damages as well as compensatory damages.
Well, just explain for the lay audience, what's the significance of punitive damages? Because I think people who aren't lawyers or haven't been part of the legal system might not know that. And of course, punitive damages are their own controversy, but just explain why that's important.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has seen fit when the Constitution is at stake and when government actors, state actors, take steps that are in blatant violation of our rights under the United States Constitution, that not only are those victims entitled to be compensated for the injuries that they suffered, but they are entitled to send a message to our government and to our government actors that you cannot do this and get away with it. And if you do this, not only will you be required to compensate, but you can be punished financially for what you've done. And so that's the whole idea under the Federal Civil Rights Act for the awarding of punitive damages over and above those that compensate for the injuries that were caused.
Julie Hurwitz, in the last 30 seconds, we know now that because this has become such a big story in New Jersey, in Ohio, in other cities, not because of the sequence of events that you described in Flint, but for other very bad reasons, people are drinking poisoned water. Lead levels are very high. This is particularly true, again, in Black and poor communities. And that's why it seems to me that your lawsuit and the idea of punitive damages and the idea of accountability could become a very major nationwide issue, because it turns out it's not just Flint. In 30 seconds, just characterize that if you would.
I hope that I hope that we can help those communities in any way that we can through the litigation of this case here. I think you're absolutely right that this is not unique to Flint. And hopefully this is just the beginning of a movement that will more effectively confront these inequalities and this level of government repression that is occurring throughout our country. I would also say that the other thing we're hoping for is that our legislature or the U.S. Court of Appeals on the case I'm working on will repeal this vicious and frightening emergency manager law.
Yeah, it's all about democracy, bottom line. Julie Hurwitz, we are out of time. We want to thank you so much, and we hope you will come back again. This is going to be an ongoing story, and of course, your litigation will be ongoing, too. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. And clear.
We are back. I am joined from Salt Lake City by Rocky Anderson. He is an attorney and a political leader who served as the 33rd mayor of Salt Lake City from 2000 to 2008. He is the executive director of the High Road for Human Rights and the founder of the Justice Party. He ran as an independent third-party candidate for president. Rocky Anderson, welcome.
Great to be with you, Brian. Thank you.
Thanks for joining. Well, we're in the middle of the 2016 election cycle. The Wall Street Journal recently wrote an editorial, and it was entitled something like, "Is an extreme political outcome possible in 2016? Meaning, could Donald Trump, for instance, actually win the nomination of the Republican Party? And could someone calling themselves a Democratic Socialist, Bernie Sanders, win the Democratic Party nomination?" And for the first time, the Wall Street Journal said, for a confluence of factors, yes, it's possible, and that this would be something really major. Of course, we don't know if that will happen, but I want to get your take. I mean, the Bernie Sanders campaign is a remarkable political effort. He was down 40 percentage points in the polls in Iowa. He had no money when he started. He was written off as like just a fringe candidate. And yet it looks now like he's got a 20-point lead in the upcoming New Hampshire primary. And he is a self-proclaimed Democratic Socialist demanding that the people rather than Wall Street be given priority. I'm not a Bernie Sanders follower, but it is remarkable politically. I'd like to ask you, as a longtime mayor of Salt Lake City and as an independent political candidate, what's your view on all that?
Well, I think this is a very, very healthy change in the American political landscape. It looked like Hillary Clinton was going to be sucking up all the oxygen in the room. There wouldn't be anybody challenging her. Everybody thought that she was going to be the candidate, which distressed a lot of us because, well, for various reasons perhaps we could get into, but in terms of her or a Republican, when it comes to sucking up to Wall Street, allowing the same kinds of abuses, the same kinds of recklessness, lack of regulation on Wall Street that her husband helped pave the way for, leading to the economic meltdown, and her hawkish, militaristic foreign policy. I don't think she's ever seen a war that she didn't love. And don't forget that she voted to give George W. Bush the authority, which is supposed to be Congress's authority under the Constitution, but they unconstitutionally delegated that authority to the president at the time. And Hillary Clinton, without doing any of her homework, without even bothering to read the National Intelligence Estimate, voted for it. So that's a long answer to your question, but I think it's important that we see how diametrically different these two candidates are. And for Bernie Sanders to finally come out as a Democrat, it gives one a little hope that maybe the Democratic Party will get back to its roots. And those roots are, and as you mentioned, he calls himself a Democratic Socialist. All that means, and I know, you know, Bill O'Reilly goes crazy calling him a socialist and such. All it means is that government serves the people rather than the corporate interests only, and only those who contribute to the campaigns. And it's along a European model that we look to government to do what government's supposed to do and what the founders had in mind when they wrote, "We the people." This was supposed to be about the people and government serving the people. So I find that a very healthy development. On the Republican side, it's so unhealthy for our country, for our nation's dealings with other countries. I think it spells possibly the demise long-term of the Republican Party, at least in its current iteration, because young people are just appalled that this buffoon, this braggart, this rude, misogynist bigot in Donald Trump could even be taken seriously, let alone being one of the leading, if not the leading, candidate in national polls. So, yeah, nobody would have dreamt a year or two ago that this could ever happen in the United States of America. And some of it's very upsetting. Some of it is very heartening and encouraging.
Let me ask you about the Democratic Party, because Sanders was certainly not from the Democratic Party establishment. I don't consider him to be a far-left radical by any means, but perhaps in the tradition of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party that's been basically put out to pasture for the past couple decades. But the Democratic Party establishment is really at war with Sanders. And when I say the establishment, I don't just mean those inside the Democratic Party specifically. The New York Times wrote an editorial coming out for Hillary Clinton on the eve of the Iowa caucuses, even before the first votes are cast. The Washington Post was completely demonizing Bernie Sanders as like a buffoon, as somebody who had vapid ideas. At first, they were saying his ideas were bold but wrong. And then when he said, yeah, they are bold ideas, they said, well, they're not bold, they're just empty. I mean, going out of their way to smash Sanders, who is, as you said, he's not talking about building a real socialist society. He's talking about a European social democratic model. But it's as if the Democratic Party establishment in and outside the Democratic Party sees that as a great threat. And I just want to ask you, as a longtime political leader, how you see the trajectory in establishment politics, because it seemed to me that it was in the 1990s during Clinton that the liberal, that even the word liberal became extinguished. It became the L word, like even liberal self-censored. And then we had the ascendancy of very, very right-wing forces. Why is the Democratic Party establishment so against Bernie Sanders, even though he represents a liberal candidacy within the Democratic Party?
Well, for one thing, because they are all lapping it up at the same trough that the Republicans have been surviving from for so many years. The Democrats, I mean, Hillary Clinton, you can look at her contributors even when she was running for Senate. One after the other identified themselves as bankers. She has pocketed hundreds of thousands of dollars personally from these large banks that have wrought so much economic havoc in this country. A year ago last October, she pocketed $400,000 from two speeches. And as we all know, she's not a very good speaker, but $200,000 per speech, two speeches to Goldman Sachs. And that was not an exception to the rule. That's how she has been doing it. And she, as soon as she got out of the Senate, and then after she finished her term as Secretary of State, she was at it again. And we know that the insurance companies are lined up behind her. She, of course, is going to poo-poo and say, oh, how ridiculous is the newspapers do this idea that Bernie Sanders has of universal health care. Well, FDR saw the same kind of resistance to Social Security. Everybody's saying, oh, that'll never happen. What a socialist idea. That's so radical. And because he was so persuasive with the people, he created a public demand for Social Security. And then he put in place post-depression measures, anti-depression measures like Glass-Steagall that prohibited the central ownership of commercial banks and investment banks and insurance companies, which Bill Clinton, with Robert Rubin, the former Goldman Sachs head, as a Secretary of Treasury, got rid of. He truly paved the way for that economic disaster. The banks made out like the bandits they are, and the people got totally screwed.
You have Goldman Sachs paying Hillary Clinton hundreds of thousands of dollars for a few speeches. Anderson Cooper in the town hall forum the other night in New Hampshire asked her, why did she take $600,000 from Goldman Sachs? And she said, oh, because they offered it, like as if that's a good answer. And you had Rubin, as you mentioned, who was Clinton's Secretary of the Treasury, taking the, you know, allowing the banks to go into extra hyper monopoly mode, getting rid of Glass-Steagall. Let me ask you, Is this the reason that you, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, you resigned from the Democratic Party. You had been the mayor of Salt Lake City for 8 years. You resigned in August 2011, I believe.
It was probably before that that I wrote the letter. And I had said for years that I had put my proud Democrat coffee mug in storage because I wasn't proud of the Democratic Party anymore. And I finally said, I'm breaking away. I will never again until I see, if I ever see it, massive changes in the Democratic Party getting back to its roots. And, you know, instead of the word Democratic Socialist for Bernie Sanders, I don't know why he and others don't say Social Democrat, because it's the same thing. That's what he is. And he's been doing this for years, standing up for the ordinary man and woman and not letting these rapacious corporations and other human beings that have, like Edelman and the Koch brothers, who have so much to gain by these reactionary bootlicking politicians that just give more and more tax breaks, more and more favors to the very wealthy and the multinational corporations. And geez, look at TPP now, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Talk about an insult to ordinary men and women, providing greater patent protection and lengthier patents for the pharmaceutical companies. So the people who are in need, who have serious medical problems and don't have a lot of money, are going to be deprived of, in some instances, life-saving medications. And they're negotiating that all in secret, keeping the terms away from we the people and the media, while inviting some 200 corporations to provide their input as they get to review these documents. So, and that's, by the way, Trans-Pacific Partnership is another one of those areas where Hillary Clinton was in favor of it. She was so positive, and now she's faced down by the likes of Bernie Sanders, and she entirely flip-flops, as was noted in the New York Times endorsement of her. They say, well, yeah, so she learns over time. Well, did she learn over time also about same-sex marriage? Did she learn over time since her last run as president? I mean, she was talking about how great TPP was. She was talking in favor of the Second Amendment and gun rights. She was talking down against driver licenses for people who aren't fully documented, immigrants in this country. And this woman has been unbelievable. And she was justifying her vote for the Iraq War when she ran against Barack Obama. And now she says, as if she can just brush this off and we can continue to be, as Gore Vidal said, the United States of amnesia. Just brushes off her vote for making war against Iraq, a country that posed no danger to either us or, at that time, even its immediate neighbors, as Secretary of State Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice said even before 9/11. She just wants to say, oh, that was a mistake. We all forget about it.
It is shameful. And Rocky, I know when we in the Answer Coalition organized a very large protest at the Pentagon in 2007 in very freezing cold weather to mark the anniversary. At that time, it would have been the fourth anniversary of the invasion. You were there with us. You were marching with us. You were demanding that the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And I mean, it was very rare for political leaders. And you were, as I said before, the mayor of Salt Lake City, marching with the people in the streets. I want to ask you about another part of U.S. foreign policy and Hillary Clinton. She said the day Muammar Gaddafi was assassinated, sodomized, killed following a long NATO bombing campaign, she said, we came, we saw, he died. She laughed, sort of giggled and thought it was very funny. I mean, this was the head of state of a sovereign and independent government. But she had been the cheerleader of the Libya war, the NATO bombing campaign. And look at Libya now. I mean, Obama just convened a meeting of anti-ISIL forces of the coalition, 23 countries in Rome. They're talking about the threat of ISIL, the so-called Islamic State. They didn't talk about Iraq or Syria. It's Libya, because big parts of Libya are now falling under the control of the so-called Islamic State. What's your view on Libya and Clinton's role in that? You know my view, obviously, since I just put it out there.
Well, Libya has been, once again, an absolute unmitigated disaster. And it was brought about by U.S. policy, our warmongering policy. And by the way, it's even more fundamental than the fact that we did what we did and we brought about this disaster for the Libyan people and opened the way to ISIS. It was contrary to our Constitution. There wasn't a declaration of war by Congress. This is, once again, one person in the executive branch making the decision that by the Constitution is reserved only for our Congress, and under the United Nations Charter, it has to, before you attack another country, it must go through the United Nations Security Council, and it didn't do that. They went off on their own and created, as we did in Iraq, a situation where there's this vacuum of power. And, of course, the most vicious, the most extreme elements come in and thrive on it, just like Al-Qaeda came into Iraq after that disaster. And then look at this. She's doing the same thing with Syria. She almost single-handedly is responsible for the bloodbath in Syria because, you know, that started off as an internal, nonviolent opposition to Assad. People had their complaints about it. And so there was an opening that was seen by Saudi Arabia and other countries. Oh, let's go in there. Then Al-Qaeda, let's go in there. This is another vulnerable country. We'll wait till there's a vacuum of power there and take over. And so we essentially have been arming ISIS in Syria in our gleeful attempt to overthrow the Assad regime. Now, yeah, Assad's not the nicest guy in the world, but who is nice out there anymore, especially when we're propping them up and telling them essentially it doesn't matter how they deal with their own people. But then we support those who are trying to overthrow them. And once again, just like in Iraq, without a plan as to what's going to happen.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank Rocky Anderson, former mayor of Salt Lake City, for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it must be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.